Hi, my name is Michael Kramer, and welcome to a podcast focused on the world of corporate real estate and everything that touches it. Hopefully, COVID is in our rearview mirror and how we're shifting the way in which we work, and also how we think about the return to the physical, perhaps corporate office, is being debated globally. Some of us have a primary or perhaps a secondary office, which is working from home. But what we do know is that the world of work has changed forever. So today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be talking to Julia Hobsbawm. She's the author and speaker on The Nowhere Office, the book and podcast of the same name, and The Future of Work and Workplace. She's also an expert on social health and networks, founder of Editorial Intelligence, presenter of the Nowhere Office podcast. Julia, I've gotten to know, and is an amazing and non-real estate person. I always think her superpower is how she synthesized lots of great data, not only about the physical office, but everything about the way we work. So, Julia, with that, welcome to the podcast and congratulations on your new book.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Now, I was lucky enough to be at your launch party last night. So I thought where we would start with Freud and why cocktails.
Yes, Freud and cocktails is alluding to the fact that the launch party for the British publication was held at the Freud Museum in London, and we served martinis in a throwback to the Mad Men era, what I call the optimism years following the Second World War, when life in the office was quite blunt and simple. So I chose the Freud Museum partly because I do think that this is a moment of psychological reassessment of who we are and what our lives mean. I think that the pandemic lifted the lid on a lot of latent trends, including the desire that had been there for many years to have work-life balance. And in fact, not only did Freud live and work in the same house in London that has become the Freud Museum, which is interesting as so many of us live and work in the same place now, but also we are craving making sense of this moment. So juxtaposing Freud and cocktails was a way of saying that we want the best of the office, which is the social side, but where we get that social side doesn't have to be in the old bricks and mortar, but that we are processing and synthesizing what this moment means. And that means we need a bit of therapy for it.
So with that as the backdrop, maybe we could start and ask you, as I said, you're not a property person, which I think makes the book even more fascinating. But where did the idea come? Maybe just a little bit of the history of how you got to write a book on and call it The Nowhere Office.
Well, I'm a management and business writer and an entrepreneur. I write for strategy and business regularly, and I've written 5 books before this book, The Nowhere Office. And at the heart of it, I'm interested in what works well and what doesn't work well. And because I'm in my mid-50s, I've worked in a lot of offices and I've run a lot of teams out of offices. I've probably had 10 proper offices in my life, in my working life, and I now have no office. And during the pandemic, during lockdown, I made the decision to jettison completely and forever the small office that my team were in. Now, I should say I don't run a multinational, so my decision to drop the office isn't quite the same as, you know, unwinding enormous leases and commitments and so on and so forth. But equally, I was struck by the fact that we've really understood that cyberspace that William Gibson predicted in 1982 is actually here. You know, $15 billion US dollars a week was spent by American companies equipping anywhere but the office to do work from. I was mulling on this from home like everybody else. I was feeling nostalgic for the office like everybody else, watching Succession, watching The Office. And I remembered my very first office job, working for Penguin Books in the King's Road in London in 1985 when I was 21. And the song that played on a loop was The Talking Heads' The Road to Nowhere. And I just had a sort of throwback memory, maybe going back to Freud. You know, I psychoanalyzed myself and my memories. And I really vividly remembered that song, the office and the filing cabinets. And I remembered thinking then in March 2020, we are nowhere near that moment and I don't think we ever will be again. And I suddenly wanted to explain that moment. And that's what I hope I've done in the book, is explain the history of how we got to that moment and to look ahead.
Interesting. So if we now dig into the book, there's a few sort of key themes I wanted to pick out, and then maybe you can add to it. But first off, you talk about learners, leavers, and leaders in the world of work. So can you maybe just dig into those a little bit more and describe them?
Yes. What I've tried to do in this book, Michael, because one of my hats is that I'm the chair of the Work Shift Commission for one of the think tanks here in the UK called Demos. And I wanted to look at shifts in work over time and in specific areas. And I wanted to look at the shifts in time and place, but also in identity at work. And the other shifts briefly are the question of productivity and purpose, networks, management, and well-being. But you're alluding to the shift on identity. And I'm suggestion being the operative word, I don't know for sure, but based on the trends and the interviews for the book and my general perspective, I'm suggesting that the identities that were becoming increasingly dominant in the workplace, in the office workplace, that is, around, you know, effectively pronouns, individuality was being celebrated and getting very, very granular. I'm suggesting that going forward, different identities are going to be germane. And those are around your life stage in the office, not around how you see yourself, but how you are in your life in relation to the work that needs to be done. Why? Because that affects when you need to be around other people physically and when you don't. And that's the future of the bricks and mortar bit of the office, is the need to be around other people when cyberspace and the digital desk is enabling so much of the actual work to be done. So the learner, the leaver, and the leader are three demographics I'm putting out there as possible new identities. The learner is obviously the younger worker who needs the mentoring, who needs the training, who might want the better coffee that an office can provide. The leaver is an older worker. They also want the camaraderie and the water cooler of the office, but they also want more space and they might have better equipped home offices. And the leader spans both of them. So I'm not saying that they have wildly opposing needs of office space, but I'm suggesting that the way we identify ourselves at work is as important as the new identity of work.
Wow. So if we dig into that a bit more, are you saying that presenteeism, if not dead, is certainly something of the past and it's now all about, and you touched on, or you at least mentioned the word productivity. So I'm really interested in exploring this idea about presenteeism being, if you like, the old-fashioned way of thinking about productivity, and it was very basic. And if we're shifting to the model that you describe, which we obviously are in many ways, how do we think about productivity?
Yes, I want to just clarify, Michael, the nowhere office isn't an argument for no office. I'm pro work and I'm pro place. I just think we are in what the architect Frank Duffy observed after the 2008 crash when he gave an interview in New York, and he said, and I quote, "The building isn't a useful unit of analysis anymore." And so my point is that how we judge where we work and when we work is now alongside why we work, the purpose point. And I'm interested in the fact that place, I think, is quite a blunt way to measure productivity, especially if you're not a factory. Now, what that means is that you can look at the history of buildings in the period of time immediately preceding the pandemic, which I call the co-working years from about 2007, when the digital era really was upon us. And buildings were both palaces of presenteeism, but also stopping off points for people to whiz around the world to conferences and to really connect with each other. Networking reached a zenith, in-person networking, before the pandemic. And yet the building became the place that was a sort of totem of the work. And I don't think it is anymore, because people want their freedom and they don't need to be present in person if they're not doing work that doesn't require them to be present in person. And so what the pandemic has done, has really crystallized that moment. Now, I think that's fantastically interesting. I think some of the way property companies are pivoting towards new models is impressive, actually. But I think that fundamentally, no, we are not going to see workplaces with any agency at all working 5 days a week from the same place ever again. I really don't think that.
I think most people would agree with you. There are obviously some good exceptions of particularly, I think, let's say US banks saying that everyone needs to be back in the office to a degree. But most of the research that we do shows 2 to 3 days is the most that we might see people back in. And I think as part of that, and you've mentioned social, and I kind of want to draw a sort of a full circle on that, because I think, as you said, pre-pandemic, there was a shift towards the individual, sort of maybe away from the employer telling the employee how and when they would work. So in the office, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and the employee becoming more attuned to, actually, I want to be able to work the way I want to work. And then we've got this idea of purpose. So do you think that social change that was going on pre-pandemic has then just been exacerbated in a good way by the pandemic, and that this trend is going to continue, meaning that we're going to get more of the individual nature of how people want to work presiding over actually what happens?
Yes, I didn't quite answer your question before about productivity. For me, productivity is not as complicated as people make out, by the way. Productivity has often been rather dryly referred to, and worker output per hour. And people have said often that knowledge workers, it's very difficult to measure productivity. And of course, it is, in the sense that a law firm measures productivity differently to a Netflix team of scriptwriters and so on and so forth. But actually, I don't think productivity is that difficult to measure. And I don't think it's that different from the factory floor to the floor plate of an office building. Productivity is when people are engaged by, motivated by, well remunerated by, fairly treated, safely at work. And then they produce more output per hour than those who aren't. And often now, they need to feel purposeful. And that sense of purpose and that sense of generational and cultural shift towards meaning and the politics of sustainability and all sorts of factors coalesced at the same time in the pandemic, which is why we've got this proverbial tipping point. None of what we're experiencing is new. Plenty of the flexibility that we're seeing has been in evidence. But what's different is what's been called the Great Resignation, and I think is in fact more accurately the Great Reevaluation, which is that pretty much every single knowledge worker in the world has become either a hybrid have or a hybrid have not. If they're a hybrid have not, as in their managers and leaders say, you have no choice, you must, ... I think the jury is out about whether they won't become part of the Great Resignation, which is they want to be hybrid haves. And of the hybrid haves, they want meaning and purpose and flexibility, all of which I think places buildings in a very interesting position.
It does. And I don't know if this is where you were going, but when you were just talking, you know, productivity sometimes is related to happiness, meaning if people are happy at work, they're probably doing a very good job and they're interacting with people and some of the things you were talking about, which is maybe one way to think about it. But when you talk about meaning, do you think there's a place for the physical office in helping to define meaning of work? So for these hybrid workers, the physical office as part and parcel of their week is something that will, albeit in a different way, create that sense of agency and that sense of connection to the business they're working for.
I think for global organizations who can afford to repurpose offices and who can afford to have lower occupancy and who can afford to use the space differently, absolutely, that will still be a calling card in the same way that in what I call the co-working years, 2006-07 to 2019-20, you know, the beanbags and the all-you-can-eat buffets and the glamorous offices became the sort of leitmotif and symbol of cool places to work. I think now those buildings, those organizations inside those buildings will be virtue signaling that they also offer hybrid. But of course, a lot of employers are much smaller than that, and they will have to let their workforces become more fully remote. And I think that your Cushman and Wakefield collaboration with WeWork is interesting. I think the development that Canary Wharf has becoming a co-working set of suites. I think the trend of Soho House, which by accident and age I'm a founder member of, I think their pivot into co-working spaces is fantastically interesting. And so I come back to this point that I think place matters, but the specificity of the place doesn't matter. You know, where you drop in could be the coffee shop, could be the hotel suite, it could be your HQ, but it might not be, even those 2 to 3 days a week. And does that matter?
I guess if we dig down another layer, for me, one of the important things about work is, in the sense that we're talking about, is your network. And obviously, this is an area you know a lot about. And one of the things that, you know, anecdotally people talk about is, oh, you know, working from home is fine, but we had to do it, but we're not seeing people. When it's more than just seeing people physically, it's actually working your network and getting from your network whatever it is that you need in order to do a better job, let's say. That might be meeting new people, being influenced from different areas. Do you see that dropping into a virtual world and people being able to continue to build their careers around a virtual network? Or is physical place something that's still important, be that the office or the coffee shop or Soho House, as you just described?
Okay, so we are social selves. And what's really interesting about this moment, the pandemic has connected people more to their social selves, which is why I celebrated the publication, not with a Zoom, but with an actual party, with actual people and actual cocktails, okay? And yet and but, the technology has surprised us, even those like me who were skeptics, which is especially on the eve of the metaverse. We're right. going to have more technology enabling seriously productive remote exchanges rather than less. And so what will remain is the absolutely irreplaceable bit of people being together, which is in fact social, purely social. The water cooler, people say, matters, and it really does, but not within a 9-to-5 work setting, because right. in that setting, water cooler means a lot of time being wasted. Let's be completely honest, right? So what matters now is to say, okay, the connection and the time wasting and the shooting the breeze side of work, which matters, bring that on and bring that into the office so that the office becomes where you celebrate, where you communicate, whether you resolve conflicts. You do the things that have to be done face to face, and everything else happens separately. Now, I'm just not sure how much employers are really up for that. That's what I think's fascinating. And by the way, I've not got the skin in the game here. I'm not advocating it. I'm just observing it and pitching my tent to say, I think hybrid is really here. It's just going to be so interesting how we go forward. But I don't know any more than anybody else, which is partly why my sort of ideas are framed in this word nowhere, which is quite negative. I'm really trying to say, well, we are nowhere where we were, and we're nowhere near where we're going to end up. Talk to me in a year or 2 years, Michael, and we may be somewhere.
Yes, the everywhere office rather than the nowhere office, perhaps, to make it positive and not use a negative word.
Well, it's not so much that I think we should worry about it being negative, but I think we should keep it real. What I'm observing, if you like, politically at the moment, and we've seen Goldman Sachs get into a pickle over this, we've seen all sorts of people get into a pickle over it, is the idea that there is a sort of new culture war with certain bosses and certain managers and certain governments saying, do your duty, get back to the office. And the workers, the skilled workers, they don't want to do that. And so really what I want is a great realpolitik to come into the conversation, which, to be fair, even to Goldman Sachs, they are now doing. But I sympathize with mass policies that have had to be ripped up in the face of the pandemic, because this trend to the nowhere office has definitely taken people by surprise. When I was first starting to write this book, lots of people shook their heads and said, well, good luck with that, but we'll all be back in the office by the time your book's out. And I was taking quite a gamble, but I felt in my bones that all of these trends were coalescing And as I say, I really don't think we will be back 9 to 5 in offices ever again.
And I think you're right. And maybe at the beginning of the pandemic, when we thought we'll be back in a month or 2 months, we would have gone back to where we were because we didn't have enough time to shift. I think the time frame, which has been speeded up because of technology, has allowed this shift to happen. And I think there's very few people who would think we're going to go back to 9 to 5. I guess that within that, there's two things that I wanted to ask about. One is the serendipitous water cooler moments, which everyone talks about. It's much easier to make those happen if everyone's in the office 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. If your time in the office is less, you're going to get less of those, which is why I was trying maybe going with the network question. So I think we are going to lose some of that, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was going to come back to the networks question. I think that managed serendipity isn't the same as serendipity, okay? So absolutely, something will be lost. The question is, what will be gained? I think that's really the question. It's the glass is half full or the glass is half empty, and I'm a glass is half full kind of a person. What I think is that as long as you appreciate, if you're a leader or a manager, that you are responsible for a workplace that is all about good work, treating people well, then you can iterate and collaborate and experiment with your workforce. And that brings in the T word, trust. So you can say to people, for instance, we know you like the value of networks. We've always sort of cauterized networking to conferences that not all of you have been able to go to because you've not been senior enough. Well, do you know what? If you come into the office 2 or 3 times a week, one of the things is we're going to give you a lunch budget to go out for lunch. We're going to give you a time budget to go and say that you're having coffee with somebody to build up. If you're a learner, you need time to build up serendipity through networks that aren't transactional. They're just meeting a guy called Michael Creamer for coffee. That's the real innovation here, is that you allow networks to happen in and around the office without trying to be rigid and prescriptive, so that, yes, you get serendipity at the water cooler, but with an awful lot of rigidity either side of it. I think people don't want that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think what you've touched on a number of times is absolutely right, that I think managers, so your leaders, have to think about how they manage and lead in a quite a different way. They've got to think about their people and all the things that you've mentioned. How are they networking? How are they getting their work done? And one of the areas you touched on a little, which again, I think to tie it to the physical office is so important. We've seen this idea of well-being come to the fore, particularly during the pandemic. Again, slightly for obvious reasons, but I think underlying that, there's a much bigger issue, which is the well-being of individuals and people seems to be getting worse. And all the stats tell us that there's a real social issue with that. And some of that must have been exacerbated by the particularly younger people being at home. So again, I think maybe workers have to see the physical office as somewhere where they get their teams together, if only to help them feel better and not fall into that trap, because obviously that's a very bad place for them to end up. So do you see the physical office as being almost shifting in what it's doing for employees?
Yes, I do. I think the physical office used to be a status symbol, a power symbol, and a means of control. And I think increasingly the professional working classes, if you like, began to see themselves as just as trapped in different ways as other kinds of workers, which is why stress has reached epidemic proportions. It's why the World Health Organization actually declared stress as the biggest epidemic of the 21st century pre-pandemic. It's why pre-pandemic stress caused $300 billion annually of lost productivity, according to the American Institute of Stress. It's why 17 million British days a year are lost to stress, and so on and so forth. So really what I wanted to do when I wrote this book was to say, this is a moment to stock take and to assess what office-based work really is and what it could be, because what it really is something that didn't work very well before. And I wondered and worried whether the scaffolding was bricks and mortar offices rather than what people feel in their lives and what work they're given to do. And so really, I want to pivot it and say, with the greatest of respect to fabulous architects, central business district designers, and so on, what actually matters first and foremost is, what work are you asking people to do? Why? When? And then where? So really, it's a repurposing of priorities. If those leaders get it right, people will want to come in to offices sometimes, like people who leave home and have good family relationships come home for the Sunday lunch, for the Thanksgiving dinner, for the red letter days. But I think that those people running offices have to accept that their professional workers have basically left home. The pandemic has liberated them and they've gone into cyberspace.
That's quite a difference. So if we look over the next 12 to 24 months, and let's assume that the pandemic is behind us, which it might not be, but let's hope and say that it is. What do you think the best companies are going to do, building on what you just said, in terms of rethinking that office space? It sounds from what you just said that we've got to start with the leaders of your three group and get them to rethink what their role is as a leader and how they manage teams. And that's going to involve a lot more of this flexibility and a complete rethink, actually, of what happens when people come to the office. Do you just see that trend now being the next sort of big trend that's kind of, as night follows day, follows on from the pandemic and everything that we've talked about?
Yes, I would say the first trend is that the leader has to become a listener. I've not been such a fan of leadership with a capital L, the top down, the I am a leader. That approach doesn't work so well in geopolitics, does it, at the moment? So, you know, the breast beating, I'm the one in control model, I think we don't want as much as we want a collegiate, tell us what's really going on kind of a model. I think the first thing is listening. The second thing is to not panic. If you have got a long lease or you're in the business of dishing out long leases, I think it's about saying there really isn't a one size fits all, but there's a one size for somebody. And you may have the right size. In other words, there are organizations that need to be present in immersive bursts and are going to need a lot of real estate in order to do that with, but they will also build in the space. Equally, I do think that some organizations will become more remote based, but they might start using real estate differently. They might start having more conferences, using hotels, using resorts, using co-working spaces differently. So I think there'll probably be a redistribution of use of place rather than, I'm certainly not predicting that everybody's going to be fully remote for all the reasons we've discussed. People need to come together, and at different life stages, people need different things. And the learners, the Generation Zs, they don't have well-appointed privacy and broadband and great coffee. They might want to be in a space with others, but all the data shows they've got freedom and they want it. And the technology gives them mobility and they don't want to lose that. So I think actually what's required is emotional literacy and an intent to respect the trends rather than a tendency to resist them. It's not a command and control moment. It's a respond, iterate, test, react moment. And if we can do that, I think it's going to be a wonderful moment, actually.
I agree with you. I think there's an awful lot that's going to happen. And I know in your book, you have, I think it's 12 predictions, right, for the what's going to happen next. I think you've probably covered off two or three of them. We've certainly mentioned the metaverse. Just before we wrap up then, Julia, because we could talk, and we have before, but you and I could talk about this for hours and differing views. Is there anything else you kind of want to add in or say about the book or where you think things are heading? And then I'm going to say to you, in 12 months' time, when you've written your next book, the follow-up, we can do this again and see how many of those predictions came true, more or less.
I think what I would say is that the Nowhere Office is a moment in history. It's a moment in the history of work, which is similar actually to the moment that began after the Second World War, when in 1945, the whole world was in reset. The whole world was building a new set of institutions. And at that moment in history, the skyscraper was the emblem of that endeavour. And it is complicated for people who run buildings to accept that the building may not be the central feature right now of work. But if it hangs on in there and repurposes, and I mean, I go back to Soho House. You know, I live in a villagey bit of London. Lots of London is villagey. And Soho House has taken over the old KFC building in Crouch End and turned it into something called Soho Works, where I did most of my book proofing. You know, these are interesting developments, the development of the suburb, the development of the out of town. So I don't think that I want people to feel gloomy about this moment. I want people to feel optimistic, but I want people to be very, very open-minded. And that's my prediction, is that the winners will be the listeners.
Great. Julia, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck, of course, with the book. I understand actually from your talk yesterday, you're the number one on Amazon business books at the moment. Is that right?
I think it's in its category of the sociology of work. It went straight in at number one, and it's in the sort of top, I think, two and three in things like productivity. So, but you know, those rankings shift, the world shifts, got to be innovative, got to be responsive. But yes, it seems to be landing at the moment. Thank you.
Well, enjoy it while it lasts. And I'm obviously the press on it has been fantastic. I'd certainly recommend it to everyone to pick up a copy and read it. There's lots of really good thoughts and insights, and as you say, things for us to do, and above all else, listen and watch what happens. So, Julia, thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon.
I hope so. Thanks for having me, Michael.
You're welcome. And before you go, thanks very much for listening. It would be great if you could leave a rating and any comments you have on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcasts. All feedback is a great way to support the What's Next in Corporate Real Estate podcast and to get great guests to share their knowledge with you and everyone else who listens. Thanks very much.